Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds
It's the Freedom News Hour of Possibilities. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with co-host Bill Westmiller. Today is Thursday, July the 3rd, 2014, one day away from Independence Day. Happy 4th, everybody. And some of the headlines we're going to be looking at today include headlines related to monetary policy. We're going to talk about California and Bitcoin. We're going to talk about the Chinese and the British making a currency deal, and we're going to start off with a little tidbit about something called the Export-Import Bank, which we've actually talked about a few times here on the show, once recently this past winter or spring, I believe, and then a couple of years ago when previous co-host Jake Towne did a rather lengthy piece connecting the Export-Import Bank to monetary policy. But, Bill, the headline you dug up said that the bank's going to crash. I think that may actually be a little bit of an overplay, but what do you think?
Well, it's an interesting congruence of the right wing that hates bailouts, corporate bailouts, and hates subsidies, and the left wing that hates corporate subsidies and, to some degree, bailouts. And so the interesting thing is that the two sides have gotten together and actually are close to being a majority declining to renew and reauthorize the Export-Import Bank. So it's an unusual thing. It's been in existence for decades, but now there's a good possibility that it may just disappear.
I once again am applauding the optimism. And there's a little birdie in my mind saying, yeah, but I'm remembering that piece that Jake did a few years ago. And in that piece, he did a nice job. He definitely pieced together a bunch of different articles that were not directly intended to be related, but showed that the Export-Import Bank is used to basically house a gigantic slush fund that the White House uses at will to influence both foreign policy and monetary policy. And I just can't for a moment believe that they're going to give that up without a fight. I think you're going to see a last-minute surge of support, patriotic appeal for keeping the Export-Import Bank going and helping to protect our country's businesses competing overseas, yada, yada, yada. But that won't be the real reason. It'll be because they want to protect that slush fund.
Well, that's probably true, and that may well be what the outcome is. The biggest argument against eliminating Export-Import Bank is that other countries do the same thing.
Yeah.
And so if we take our supports out and don't subsidize exports and imports, then we're going to be at a disadvantage because France or Germany or whoever it is subsidizing their business exports to our country.
And that's also, I think, the public argument made about why we keep it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, every country does their own protectionism, and as a consequence, we have more protectionism than anything else. Instead of a vibrant international market, it's constrained by every individual government.
When have we had a vibrant international market? Was there a time when we had that?
Well, you know, it's been badmouthed on frequent occasions, but the World Trade Organization, WTO, has been very active over the past decade or two in reducing tariffs. Now, tariffs are, you know, not subsidies. They're restrictions on imports from other countries. So they put a big premium on, you know, exporting California cows or whatever it might be. So the tariffs have been reduced substantially among all the different countries in the world over the course of the past two decades. But the flip side of that isn't part of the WHO or WTO. So what may happen as a consequence of this is that our Export-Import Bank may be renewed on the condition that we engage in WTO negotiations with other countries to also simultaneously reduce their support and subsidies for business. So that, I think, is more likely outcome.
That was very nicely, deftly done. You completely ignored my question.
Of course.
No,
I agreed with your premise that the possibility of this actually occurring is probably not stupendous.
Yeah. That's a good way to put it.
Well, I mean, what actually, if people don't understand what the Export-Import Bank does, is they basically guarantee loans from other governments and other businesses in other countries that are given by our manufacturers so that these other countries can buy our products. Now, if that other business goes bankrupt, the Export-Import Bank is out its whatever number of dollars they've guaranteed. Of course, the taxpayers cover it. So it's a direct corporatism. It's a subsidy for transactions that wouldn't otherwise occur without the government's guarantee.
And subsidy is the word because they're not lending at market rates. They're lending at below market rates because they're using basically the government rate, which is below market, and they're using that as the basis for these loans. So it's essentially a way for the largest corporations to get around the lending rates.
Yeah.
But they really need to because they already have the preferred rate anyway, but, you know.
Yeah, the larger corporation. I read something to the effect that the Export-Import Bank loan guarantees were distributed something in the neighborhood of 40 to 60% between big and small businesses. So there's a lot of small businesses that benefit from it, too, but the benefit is something that shouldn't exist in the first place. We shouldn't be giving businesses money to export or import goods at all. It should be the free market.
Like I said, my first question, when did you think we ever had a vibrant free market? I'm not sure we've ever had one.
Oh, when we've had one? There was a vibrant free market, I would say, up until the 1920s in the United States.
No, I didn't count that because of the amount of manipulation that was going on, particularly where monetary policy was concerned, pretty much undermined that.
Well, it's always a relative thing. It was the 1920s when the Fed and all these export-import banks and subsidies and bailouts and stuff like that started occurring.
They actually started before that because that was the basis for J.P. Morgan's empire in the 19-teens, which contributed directly to one of the reasons, one of the really true reasons why the U.S. entered World War One, because he had all that money invested in the Allied powers and all of those, you know, weapons and tanks and all kinds of motorized vehicles and all the stuff that he had fed into the war effort. That was basically financed through vehicles that the Export-Import Bank didn't exist at that time, but through vehicles that basically emulated Export-Import Bank activities. So, I mean, the nation thing really preceded the 1920s.
Yeah, well, some did, undoubtedly. I'm not saying that there was ever a perfect free market in the United States or any other country in the world, but relative to our current circumstances, obviously the amount of corporatism has expanded enormously over the past 80 or 90 years.
At least, yes. Now, another piece of news that had come out the last, I guess it was in the last 2 weeks, wasn't it? Was China and Britain announcing that they had made a currency deal, basically moving one step away from the dollar reserve system. And that's a significant piece of news.
Yeah. No, and this is something that the Chinese and the Russians had already done.
That's right.
But this is kind of surprising that they have kicked the Chinese have kicked the dollar out of the transactions with Great Britain when it comes to, you know, whatever kind of currency trading they're doing. They're just ignoring the dollar and just going to direct transactions for any kind of business deal or any kind of global finance.
Very interesting, too, that China has not only succeeded in negotiating, as you pointed out, that deal with Russia and this new deal with Canada, but they've also got deals in place with Japan and New Zealand. Mm-hmm. So the steps that lead to the U.S. and the U.S. dollar no longer being a worldwide reserve currency are being taken, and they're actually moving along perhaps faster than I thought. I'm a little surprised that Great Britain signed on to that one, but they did, and that's a big blow. That's a blow that's not being reported anywhere among the major media for certain, but it's a big blow to the White House, to the current Obama administration, to future presidential administrations that want to have the power that the dollar gives them. The power is being taken away from them. And so they're not going to like that very much. But the people who are going to like it even less are the American people, because this makes it much more difficult for the Fed to continue to get away with essentially bullying the world with its policies in order to flood the world with its money so they can, you know, bail out the U.S. economy and all that kind of thing. They're starting to run out of line here. They're starting to run out of rope.
Yeah, well, it's for many, many decades, maybe even centuries, the U.S. dollar was the world currency. And there are dozens of countries that use the U.S. dollar as their basis. And as that influence shrinks, it suggests to anyone involved in currency trading that the U.S. dollar is on the downslope, that the trust and confidence that the U.S. dollar is going to be viable over the next century or decade or whatever has diminished enormously. And we were talking last week about some of the people predicting the possibility that even Russia might go to a gold standard, which would be a total, you know, serious blow to the dollar. We may end up trading in rubles instead of U.S. dollars with the rest of the world.
I have to admit, I don't honestly believe that Russia's going to go to a gold standard, because that's not in Putin's interest for certain. And it's not in the interest of the oligarchs in Russia to do that. It would work against most of what they're trying to do. But I do agree that Russia is continuing to try to move away from the dollar by whatever means. And they're not the only ones. There's a lot of countries trying to do that. And I know I've said this before, and I just said it a few minutes ago, but I've got to say it again. I don't think Americans are ready for it. I don't think Americans understand that when this happens, when the dollar loses its influence, it means that all of the things that Americans are used to having the government do to so-called save the economy, to subsidize, to stimulate, all those things no longer become operative the way they did before, because now the price can no longer be put off. The accountability can no longer be put off. That's the advantage to having your currency be a reserve currency. You can get away with stuff like that for a long, long period of time. But when the day comes that you're no longer getting away with it, when the day comes that the currency is no longer a reserve currency, then the usual forces that come into play whenever you have monetary expansion go on, they come in very, very quickly. And that's the part I don't think Americans are ready for.
Well, I don't know if it's terribly quick. There are a lot of economists who have been preaching doom and gloom for many, many years, saying, you know, the crash is just around the corner, this can't be sustained, we have more debt than Greece, we're you know, bankrupt in terms of our obligations and entitlements and everything else, and there's just no way to avoid either rampant inflation or economic disaster.
I agree that it wasn't around the corner. I don't think there's any real reason to believe that it was. I do think that it was inevitable in the long run. I think they're right, at least on that part. But the part where they say it was around the corner, no, I think they were wrong all along. And the reason they were wrong was because the dollar was a reserve currency. That was the fly in the ointment. What I'm saying is that fly in the ointment is no longer going to be irritating the situation anymore. Once the U.S. dollar loses its influence as reserve currency, that's gone. And now the big barrier that prevented it from happening quickly is gone.
Well, the thing with public opinion is that whenever possible, the powers that be avoid the impression that the shit has hit the fan. It doesn't hit the fan all at once. It's dribbled in. And eventually, you know, like a boiled frog, you're covered with shit, and you haven't noticed that it's gotten to be more shit than it was before.
That was a heck of a mixed metaphor. You realize that you're boiling a frog. No, I won't even go there.
I'm just saying it's more likely to be a whimper as the U.S. dollar fades and you know, prices go up and inflation goes up and interest rates go up and different sectors of the economy start crashing and there's defaults left and right and all over the place. But it's subdued and suppressed so that people aren't aware of every little step along the way. And eventually
I'm not so sure about that. I mean, they're able to get away with what they've been able to get away with for a number of reasons, one of which is the dollar as a reserve currency. Another one is that they've been manipulating the way that key economic performance indicators are measured, such as the inflation rate, manipulating it to the point where it's almost a meaningless rate. But because people haven't experienced any major increase in prices, yeah, they've seen food prices go up, they've seen the cost of rent go up, they've seen clothing costs go up, and so on and so forth, but they haven't seen a sustained push in that direction. It surges for a bit and it stops, it surges for a bit and it stops, and so it's not a continuous thing. Once they start seeing a continuous one, though, and the government still continues to say, well, there's no inflation going on, that's where I think they start to lose credibility. And add in the fact that the reserve currency situation goes away, I think that actually becomes a different psychological scenario than what we've been having up until now. So I'm not so sure the old rules apply anymore.
Yeah, well, it's people do take note, and it's the people that are, you know, aware of what's going on in the economy that obviously take first note, and then those are the people get rich. But for example, the U.S. economy shrank by 2.9% annual rate in the first quarter. The first 3 months of this year, the economy didn't grow at all. It shrank. Mm-hmm. Now, the original estimate was that it had grown 1%, which they thought, well, you know, it's growth. It's not great. But so here we go again on another dive into a recession that hasn't ever quite hit the point of being a depression. But people notice that, and that has an impact on, you know, how they invest their money. Of course, for the average Joe Blow, the thing that's most obvious is unemployment.
Right.
And, of course, they skew the unemployment numbers all over the place. But even in the news reports, like, for example, I think there was a jobs report today saying the economy had added 288,000 jobs in June. And nowhere in the article, as a consequence, the unemployment rate dropped from 6.3 to 6.1%. Now, if you recall back a few years ago, the goal for the Fed was under 5% unemployment.
Mm-hmm.
And they try to jiggle the numbers as best they can, but they still can't get it under that 5%. But here's what they don't say in the article. Every month, there are 300,000 people who leave the workforce, either because they die, or they've hit old age or retirement, or they've moved out of the country, or whatever it is.
But most commonly because they exceeded their unemployment benefits, so they're no longer qualified to receive unemployment, so they're no longer counted.
Exactly. Well, and this is another factor, too, and we were talking about this last week. The unemployment insurance had been extended out to 99 weeks. What is that, 3 years? Versus the original 27 weeks that you had to find a new job.
And 99 weeks would be just under 2 years.
Right. Yeah, you're right. I'm thinking months. but here's the point is that it disappeared with very little commotion and very little public news commentary. That 99 week deal just suddenly disappeared from the budget a few months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a consequence, it's obvious that the number of people who are able to report has gone down.
Mm-hmm.
Because the 99-week, they're just off the rolls. They don't
That's
exist
right.
anymore. They've ceased to be seeking employment.
We've been talking about this for quite some time, too, about the role, if you will, of the people who no longer count as being part of the workforce, not because they got rich and decided to retire, but because they simply have not been able to get work and their benefits ran out, so they just aren't counted anymore. And it's a very significant number. I mean, I think it was a couple of weeks ago I pointed out that the growth and the number of people who are no longer part of the workforce since the 2008 crisis was somewhere around 12 million people, which exceeded the entire list of unemployed people officially counted. So.
Yeah, you know, there are other factors involved, too. I mean, one of the things that this jobs report pointed out was that the unemployment rate for blacks was 10.7%.
Mm-hmm.
It's 5.3% for whites, but when you average, you know, everybody's racial category out, it comes out to this 6.1%. So there's a consequence
here. For the young people, it's even worse than that. If I remember correctly, I haven't seen it in a while, but if I remember correctly, for young people 25 and under or somewhere in that range, it's somewhere around, 20, 25%?
Yeah, yeah. It's extremely high. It's even higher in some of the foreign countries, like France is like up to 50% youth unemployment. But another number that they don't usually promote or take note of is the number of people who are doing part-time work that are still looking for full-time work. They're considered employed, but there were 275,000 in June that were looking for full-time work and couldn't get it. Now, those people, 275,000, are part of the 288,000 that they claim to have added to the economy.
And those are just the ones that are counted.
How's that?
Those are just the ones that are being counted. I'm convinced they're not counting part-time people accurately.
Probably
not. So many people have part-time jobs these days. And when I look at the fact that the politicians on both sides of the House and the presidency, all of them are at record lows in terms of public approval rating. By the way, it's a little funny story I'll tell it in a minute, but because of the fact that they're all at record lows in terms of approval rating, I have to think that the number one factor driving those approval levels isn't so much Congress doesn't get anything done. It isn't so much whether or not Obamacare is working or not working. It isn't so much most of it. It's, do I have a job? What's my family? Is my family able to feed themselves, to clothe themselves, to house themselves? And I really believe that there is a major crisis going on that is that the government figures are deliberately designed to cover up so that we can't see it. And I have a sneaking suspicion, maybe not in 2014, but I have a sneaking suspicion that by 2016, that's going to start showing up at the polling booth. How is it going to express itself? I can't tell you. But I just have this very strong belief that that's what we're going to see when all is said and done. It's going to be what's driving people when it comes to, you know, who they're deciding to vote for. Now, the funny story I mentioned earlier, there was a poll that came out this past week asking who is the most unpopular, who is the worst president we've had in the history of the country. And it was a dead heat between President Barack Obama and former President George W. Bush.
Nixon wasn't far behind.
Which is really scary to have Nixon come in third to those guys. That's really scary.
That's true. There's disappointment no matter which, you know, wing of the spectrum or corner of the quadrant you are. There's different issues where different things are happening that are disappointing everybody one way or the other. And so the dissatisfaction comes from those issues where they think Obama isn't doing enough or he's doing too much or whatever it is. It's an interesting blend. But since you mentioned Obamacare, last week the Bureau of Economic Analysis found out that the overall spending on health care had grown by 9.9% in the last quarter. It's the biggest growth since 1980. So Jay Carney, who was still in the press office at the time, says, well, this is fantastic. You know, consumer spending is helping to drive economic growth, and this is directly related to the increase in people who have insurance because of the Affordable Care Act. So the number was, you know, 9.9% increase in how much people have to spend, and that's a success. Because broken windows improve the economy. It's the old.
Well, it actually is reflective of the understanding that modern economists have about how economies work. In their view, economics is driven by spending, and that's a central tenet of most economists today. The ones that you and I might call the Keynesian economists, although many of them would dispute the title. But the fact is, most economics today is spending-driven economics. That's their measurement. And the more spending increases, the healthier your economy supposedly is. And it's simply not true. Just because people are spending money doesn't mean that you have healthy economics going on. Because as you just pointed out, it can be manipulated. It can be turned into something where it's all a facade created by, you know, some sort of government forceful rules. And it doesn't actually suggest anything healthy about the economy. It just means spending went up. So there's an excellent example of how it's just an illusion.
There's two interesting follow-ups to this. Of course, all along, the president and the supporters for ACA and Obamacare have been saying that the primary purpose of the thing was to hold health spending in check, bend the cost curve so the amount of money that was being spent would be reduced. Now, when this 9.9% increase came out, you know, they said, oh, that's marvelous. We're, you know, stimulating the economy and all this kind of stuff. Well, as it turned out, like with all, you know, government bureaucrats, they came out with a revised number. And it turned out that it hadn't grown 9.9% in the first quarter. It had actually fallen by 1.4%. That was a revision that they announced just a couple of days ago, saying that, no, it hadn't gone up. So now I'm waiting for the press secretary to come out and say, well, that's fantastic. The costs are, you know, the spending is going down, and people are, you know, not happy, are much healthier than they used to be, so they're not spending as much money. You know, no matter which way the numbers go, they got a storyline.
Well, obviously what happened was somebody inside the White House got all nervous because they figured they were going to have to defend a thing about increasing health care costs. So they said, look, you got to change those numbers around, and they did. I mean, there's government effectiveness right there, right?
I don't know the bureaucrats do that intentionally. You know, I come out with, you know, one extreme and then go to the other extreme, you know, 3 weeks later. But that seems to be common in, you know, unemployment reports and economic growth reports. They get adjusted every couple of weeks. So you're never really sure where you're at. But there's another aspect of the Obamacare thing that's becoming more and more obvious, and that is that all of the health insurance companies that are involved in these exchanges are starting to announce the new prices for 2015, which will go into effect on October 1st. And they're coming up with anywhere from a 10 to a 30% increases in the premiums. Now, once they get released and once people see that this Obamacare program is not in any way reducing their insurance costs, whether or not it's, you know, increasing or decreasing their health care costs, I think that's going to have an impact. I think there's also, you know, all kinds of mini bubbles that are, you know, floating around on the surface of the economy that could start to break and actually get a lot of attention. The stock market made a new high today. All of that big increase in stock market prices is a consequence of debt. Mm-hmm. The consequence of these large corporations borrowing money through their banks via the Fed and rebuying their stocks, and that automatically increases the price. Well, the amount of debt these companies have incurred is higher than it's been since 1929. So that bubble has to break somewhere along the way. And when people see the stock market going down, then they psychologically start to worry.
Yep,
so
that's exactly
that's
right.
Going to be an indicator as well.
Yeah, it reminds me of something I think I mentioned this actually a couple of weeks ago, but it brings to my mind again. A great little video I saw presented by a professor of positive psychology at Harvard University named Sean Aker. A little 12-minute video. If you get a chance, go look at it on YouTube. It's a TED Talk video. But in the presentation, he's talking about positive psychology, of course, and he shows a graph. It's a nice, neat graph with all these little dots and a nice, perfect parabola curve, except for one dot that's sticking way, way up outside of the curve. And he tells us two very interesting things about it. First of all, he says all the data in the curve is fake. And secondly, he tells us that the outlier is something that all statisticians know they can eliminate it, and the reason they know they can eliminate it is that it's screwing up the data. Well, that pretty much becomes the basis for how statisticians look at data, and he's right. That's exactly what statisticians do. That's what the government statisticians are doing. So if you ever wanted to know how they get away with messing around with the data and creating positive numbers one way and then negative numbers the other way on the same data, because they eliminate whatever outliers they want to eliminate because they can claim statistically through laws of statistics that it's okay to do so.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, there is nothing more beneficial to government than to hide things from people, and that statistics is the way they do it.
Absolutely. Well, let's take a break, and then after the break, we can get depressed about more statistics, and
sure.
Plus we'll also take a little bit more of the depressing things about Obamacare and even more depressing things about civilians and
drones.
Wait
a second. We're supposed to be optimistic. We're supposed to be looking at future optimism. We started with optimism, but I don't think we're ending that way.
Well, Well, then we're going to have to end with optimism. So okay. We're going to look at the possibilities of what happens when all this comes crashing to the ground. How about that?
Okay.
This is the Freedom News Hour. Possibilities here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we'll be right back. We're back here on the Freedom News Hour. Welcome to on this Thursday evening. And one thing we forgot to mention, Bill, while we were talking about monetary stuff, California just this past week passed a law that the governor Jerry Brown signed into the law that basically made it legal for Californians to engage in the use of currencies other than the U.S. currency. Of course, Reuters and others decided that this meant that California was legalizing Bitcoin, and that's what turned all the headlines into, you know, the juicy kind of headline. But I thought we should just mention that because you said we should mention possibilities and happy stuff. So for the Bitcoin supporters out there, which you and I are not among them, here's a little happiness for you.
Actually, the law itself was an interesting consequence of one town in the Bay Area issuing its own Chamber of Commerce currency. And the feds came down on them, the California State Police came down on them, and created all kinds of pain and suffering. It didn't have anything to do with Bitcoin, but that was why they had to modify the law, was to make these community currencies valid in terms of, you know, using them to purchase merchandise and so on and so forth. I don't know the details of exactly what the program was, but it was... You know, the Bay Area was up in arms over the elimination of their community currency, and that was what the bill was intended to solve, not Bitcoin.
Well, that certainly puts the Bitcoin people into their own place, doesn't it? You just took all the wind out of their sails. Don't you realize that? By the way, something that we didn't really mention earlier when we were touching on some of the things that have been going on, we said we're going to touch on NSA, and I think we should at least do a couple of those while we have a half hour left in the show.
Sure.
First of all, let's start off with the first one you had on the list for the NSA, which has an interesting, rather intriguing headline, not five eyes, but 193 foreign eyes. Tell us what that's all about. I mean, first of all, reiterate for people what the Five Eyes is, because they may not have remembered, and then tell us what the story is about, because it's kind of a cute
People will remember from our prior discussions, the Five Eyes are the U.S., Canada, New Zealand, Australia, five countries that share all of this intelligence information totally among themselves. And so those are kind of considered to be privileged people. And what I was pointing out a few weeks back, or speculating, rather, that what was happening with the NSA was they are, according to law, they cannot tap a U.S. person's phone lines or monitor their Internet transactions. But Britain can, or Germany can. And so what happens is that the British and Germans and 192 other countries around the world are doing all their intelligence on U.S. citizens, which is in compliance with their laws, and then they are transferring the information back to the NSA. So the NSA isn't actually spying on U.S. citizens. It's letting other countries do it, and then they report back to the NSA. And so that's what the program is called, Rampart AI. I have no idea where the name came from, but basically it was... all these countries have an agreement. Of course, the U.S. taxpayers are paying for these other countries to build up their capabilities. But they're data mining from about 70 different fiber optics cables and Internet circuits around the world. All of the communications, for example, if you're making a phone call to Joe's Pizza, that call, if it's, you know, something like VoIP, could actually go through Germany because of the way the Internet works. So while it's in Germany, they can tap the call. The Germans can tap the call, and then they send the information to the NSA. So this is happening with 70 different cables and networks all around the world that the NSA doesn't want anybody to know about. but they're getting the results of all the surveillance in other countries.
And this is particularly ironic, shall we say, given the fact that a board called the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board, which is basically created by the government in a 2007 law, I believe it was, in order to, quote, investigate, unquote, whether or not the NSA was exceeding its authority regarding wiretapping and, you know, picking up metadata and all that kind of stuff. And they went out of their way to staff it with five people who had credentials from outside of the NSA to make it look like it's an independent and independently minded board. Of course, three of the members were from the Justice Department previously, and only one person previously worked in any capacity for a civil liberties group. And
they're all good old boys, in other words.
And even his credentials are a little bit in question. Yeah. But the really ironic part, especially in light of what you just described, is that this particular board issued a rather long report Tuesday in which they said that there's really nothing wrong with what the NSA is doing at all. I especially love it because of their name, the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board. It's basically saying that there's no violation of civil liberties going on here. There's no violation of the law. Everything they're doing is hunky-dory. Well, yep. I guess if you get around your own laws by going overseas to 193 other countries who aren't restricted by your laws so you can get the data that you want anyway, then everything's hunky-dory.
Yeah, well, the NSA is complying with the law. I mean, they're authorized to exchange intelligence information with all these other countries, 193 other countries, and as long as they aren't the ones that are listening to the calls and picking out based on content and monitoring Internet transactions themselves, then it's perfectly fine. It's perfectly legal because the FISA, which is Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, says here's what the NSA can do on its own under current authorities. And they're complying with that. They're just getting it from somewhere else.
Well, I certainly feel protected. I don't know about you.
Well, there's a lot of mishmash going on, but it's... the courts are kind of waffling around this issue, as is Congress. The Supreme Court came out with a ruling the other day on cell phone searches by local police, nothing to do with the NSA, but they made some statements that are going to be a little troublesome when some of these NSA cases actually get to the Supreme Court, mm-hmm. And there are several of them that are on the way. Some of the district courts have said, yeah, the NSA is fine. It's doing everything according to law and so on and so forth. And others have said, hey, this is a direct violation of the Fourth Amendment. You know, whether you call it targeting or collection doesn't make a difference as far as the Fourth Amendment is concerned. You are searching. You are getting the information. The NSA waffling about saying, yeah, well, you know, we're collecting all of the local phone calls and all of the Internet traffic, but we don't look at it. That's called targeting, and we're complying with the law, and we only target those people who are associated with maybe on one or two or maybe three bounces some foreign terrorist organization.
That's actually called BSing is what that's called.
that's the refined legal term that you
used. There wasn't actually a very kind of optimistic quasi-optimistic piece of news that came out regarding the NSA, though. Turns out that the top prosecutor in Germany is actually thinking about prosecuting the NSA. Now, how effective that's actually going to be is another question, but at least they're willing to try. That's something. Of course, the only reason they want to prosecute is because they want to go after him for tapping Angela Merkel's phone. But, hey, I'll take anything at this point.
Well, that's a correct statement about the threat, and this was, you recall, fomented as a consequence of Snowden revelation that Angela Merkel was being wiretapped. And all kinds of German diplomats and bureaucrats were being wiretapped by the NSA, which is perfectly legal under U.S. law for them to listen to anything they want to overseas. But that obviously got them a little bit upset when they discovered this was going on. But today's story is that Germany is the NSA's largest listening post in Europe. Among those 193 countries, we originally thought it was Britain that was doing most of the surveillance, But it turns out the, oh, here we go with German, Wunderschnacken Ricken Tynen Deist.
Say that three times fast.
You call it BND to make it simple. That they are providing more information to the NSA than the NSA is collecting. And this has not just to do with Germans, but Americans whose phone calls or internet communications go through Germany. Germany grabs it all, and they do all their searches and scans according to their laws, which say, you know, Britain has some privacy protections, but they only protect Britons. They don't protect Americans. Germany has its privacy laws. They protect the Germans. They don't protect the Americans. So Germany turns out to be number one, and Britain probably number two, in terms of collecting actual content of telephone calls and internet transactions and passing it back to the NSA.
Well, actually, to be more precise, Germany doesn't really have any protections for their own people. What they have is protections for their government.
Right.
Because the particular code, it's Article 99 of the German Penal Code, and it states, those who carry out secret service activities for a foreign power against the German state are subject to up to 5 years, or in extreme cases, up to 10 years in prison. So they don't really care so much about what's happening to the German people. It's just Angela Merkel.
Well, the thing is that the internet service providers in Germany who participate in the internet, which is a worldwide connection system, means that they get information from other countries, and they get information from Germany, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's happening is that the Germans are trying to prevent these ISPs from looking at German communications. Now, how you distinguish an internet communication being from Germany or other places is not an easy thing to do. It's not immediately obvious like the Internet Service Protocol. And so they're kind of in a legal quagmire in terms of who might be complicit with the NSA in providing information or who might be complicit with British intelligence that's, getting information on German government activities. So it's a messy legal thing that's probably not going to have any effect at all.
Well, it probably has a political effect in Germany because the German politicians want to project the idea that in some ways they're protecting the individual German people, even though they're not. So what better way to distract attention from the Germans' role in the overall NSA structure than to sue the NSA for tapping Angela Merkel's phone? It's a great misdirection play.
Yeah. And there was another Snowden document that said there have been several conferences, G9 and P4 and XYZ and UN and everything else, where the U.S. explicitly was tapping every communication that went out of the hotel where these meetings were being held. And all that information, because it's a foreign country, they can do that. All this information was then being provided to the U.S. negotiators, so they knew exactly what their negotiating position was for all the other countries that were involved. So it's, I don't know whether that's a credible or even a wise method of conducting diplomacy and negotiations, because people are going to distrust you. They're going to, make every effort possible to hide their positions and negotiating stands and so on and so forth. So
well,
there is
one piece of hope, I think, and that piece of hope is an article that you dug up a few weeks ago, I believe, which shows that all of this content, this stuff being grabbed by the NSA, either internally or externally through their spying partners and grabbed that way, it's now also being shared overseas with other governments. So essentially, the sharing of content is knowing no bounds, and all of the governments are getting it. As that continues to play out, I suspect that that's ultimately what leads to some sort of a battleground. I don't know where the battleground is going to come in yet, but it's creating more and more dissatisfaction among average people around the world. And eventually, I mean, I've never really believed in the concept of consent of the governed, because so much happens without the consent of the governed. But it is true that if enough people, and by enough, I mean a large chunk, a large majority of the population, get really incensed about something, then something gives, something changes. Some, if nothing else, you know, the government puts on another dog and pony show to assure everybody that all is well, but something happens. And I suspect something's going to happen based on this, the fact that all of this information is being shared with all of the governments of the world. And that's what we're ultimately going to find out. And that, I think, is going to spook some people.
Well, what's disconcerting is that actual news that has already been publicly released dies.
It does.
Fades
yeah.
away. And I recall from maybe 3 months ago that one of the Snowden documents revealed that the NSA, when it's collecting all this U.S. data, isn't targeting and isn't looking at it, but it's sending all of that data, including content, for either telephone calls or internet transactions, to Israel.
Mm-hmm.
With a little note that says, by the way, you know, here's all the stuff we have, and you're welcome to use it, but if you happen to notice that you know, there's any U.S. government officials' communications here, can you just, you know, erase those?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and, you know, that kind of, if that's any indication of what they're doing with these other countries, we don't have to worry about the NSA. We have to worry about everybody else in the world knowing exactly what's going on and invading our privacy on a daily basis with the help and assistance of the NSA and the FBI.
Right, and that's actually where I see the hope. I know this is kind of a bizarre, contorted sort of thing, but the hope is that these governments are getting so secure in the constant use and receipt of all this massive amount of information and all the ways they're able to use it. They're going to be using it. They're going to use it in ways that the U.S. government, for all of its flaws, would never actually do, at least not in the short term, because there are a lot of governments that are a lot more offensive or totalitarian or whatever you want to call it, and they'll be glad to use this to crack down on anybody and everybody they figure to be a threat to themselves.
Yeah.
As that happens more and more and more, and especially if it happens quickly, so there's a lot of it, there's a big increase of it going on, that's where I think people start to take notice. And that's where the old news reports start to get pulled out by, you know, bloggers and researchers and so forth who are saying, you know, this has been going on for quite some time, yada, yada, yada. So
yeah.
I still have hope that this is actually going to explode at some point because they're getting giddy, they're getting sloppy, they're getting to the point where, you know, it's so commonplace that they're taking it for granted. They're forgetting, I think over time they're going to forget that they have to be careful, that they can go too far and they can actually get found out by the people of their countries, respectively, to the point where it works to their own detriment. I think they're going to get, you know, lazy about it.
Well, it isn't so much that they get lazy, but that there are actually people that work for government that have ethics. You know, people like Snowden, and they see what's going on, and they start releasing this information. For example, there was a story in Politico the other day that the House of Representatives panel on intelligence discovered that the IRS had illegally given the FBI 1.1 million pages of documents relating to taxpayers shortly before the last election. Now, even if the you know, the IRS isn't on your case, like you know, allegedly they were on the case of Tea Party nonprofits, they have accidentally and illegally handed over all this documentation to the FBI, and of course the FBI can do whatever it pleases with that information,
including erase the emails.
Including erase email, yeah, right. But meanwhile, there are other, you know, totally aside from the NSA, there are other federal bureaus. For example, the Federal Housing Finance Agency, Consumer Financial Protection Agency, posted a little teeny tiny notice in the Federal Register saying that they were expanding their database programs to include identifiable information that reveals actual users and discloses all of the financial information that they have about those users. And this is practically everybody. The FHFA is what it's called, and this was Internal Planning Department. It monitors 5% of all mortgage transactions. So if you thought that the your mortgage was an issue between you and your bank, or maybe with Fannie and Freddie, it's now going through the government databases and being collected. Total access to all of your financial information.
And apparently it's not only your financial information that's at risk, it's your personal health information as well, because there was the political story that came out this week talking about the likelihood that there's going to be a big cyber hack on health records. And it kind of points to the fact, now the article is a bit speculative, they do provide some data to suggest their claim, but it does point out something very, very important, which is up until now, hackers have targeted certain kinds of targets. They targeted, for credit card information so that, they could get money they could spend easily. They've targeted for, big corporates that they didn't like what the corporates were doing. But as they become more and more prolific, and it's not like what the government does to crack down on them is going to achieve any significant gains, because even when they do happen to manage to find a particular hacker network, it's replaced by five more within about 10 minutes. So it's not like it's going away anytime soon. But I think we're going to see more hacking of more different kinds of records. We already know that there's the hacker group Anonymous, which has a history of hacking for political purposes. I don't see any reason to believe that that's not going to expand. I mean, do you?
No, I'm sure it is. The story was from an independent research company that said there were 353 breaches across all of the healthcare industry where they were able to obtain, theoretically, information on the person's health history.
Mm-hmm.
And the value of knowing not just all the financial information, but all the medication, health problems, health records, and so on, is much more valuable to a criminal than just having a Social Security number or even mm-hmm. just having a credit card number.
Yeah,
because they can use that for all kinds of nefarious purposes, including bribery and extortion and everything else.
Yeah.
So
and ultimately, they are after the money. That is the driving factor most of the time. But there's also the political side, too. I think it's both. And you're right, that particular article focused on the economic side, on the theft of money side. But I wouldn't rule out the political side. I think that's going to play a bigger role as well. So I think we're going to see a very large increase in that in the years ahead.
Yeah, it's there are a couple of states that have actually reported that they have been hacked. Their health exchange system was hacked, and they didn't know. Of course, they have worse tracking system than the federal government does, or even the NSA does. They don't know what these hackers got, but they know that there were breaches of their system, and people, were able to access their healthcare exchange and retrieve passwords and identities and Social Security numbers and all kinds of information. I think Vermont was one of them, and I don't recall the other one. And it's very rare that they admit that sort of thing has happened. People that have health concerns they don't want, particularly for people to know about publicly, are going to start discovering that people know about it.
And add in the fact that the draw for somebody who is a computer security expert, expert computer programmer, expert at all this kind of stuff, the draw for them to go to work for a government as opposed to a Google or a Facebook is very, very small, which means that the caliber of the people who go into government to create these websites, create the databases behind them, create the various apps and other forms of software that are interacting with them, they don't have the technical skill that the hackers have, and they certainly don't have the technical skill that the corporate programmers have. They're lower down on the food chain, so to speak. So it's a really uneven game. I mean, the one thing that the corporations had, they had the money they could hire the best and the brightest, and so they would do that, and that has been their best defense against what the hackers are doing, because the hackers are also very sophisticated, too. But put the hackers up against the government programmers, it's kind of like putting up, the Yankees against a Class A minor league team. It's not a fair contest at all. So another reason to think that there's going to be a whole lot more activity in the future.
Well, one of the things, there was a story that I read a few weeks back as to how the FBI and the NSA work together to help fight cybercrime, right? Mm-hmm. So what do they do? They find a hacker. If it's somebody they can get their hands on, they arrest him. They say, we're going to put you in jail for the rest of your life unless you go to work for us. In which case, you will get a nice, comfortable salary. You'll get a security clearance. You will be able to do all these different things. So work for us, and we'll forget the charges. And that's how they're recruiting some of the best hackers, is by working with corporations. They are able to identify who the hackers are, arrest them, and then recruit them to become part of the NSA organization.
Unfortunately, of course, you have to be able to arrest enough hackers to overcome the growth in the hacker population.
That's true.
Because this is a war of attrition, if you will. It's not like you can just hire a few good hackers and they're going to be able to defeat the rest of the hacker industry. That's not the way it's going to work.
True.
Sadly speaking. Unfortunately, before we get to our own radio show hack, we're going to have to end it because we're out of time.
We can't hack the clock?
We can't hack the clock. We haven't hired the right programmer. Anonymous, where are you? Well, we need you. But Bill, it's been a pleasure as usual.
Sure.
We'll see you all next time here on the Freedom News Hour Possibilities. Good night, everybody.
Don't you know, we're talking about a real...